watching Beyond the Headlines with Mike Matthews.
What is up, Beyond Clean world? My name is Michael Matthews. That is Hank Balch. This is Beyond Clean, Beyond the Headlines. And we are going to be discussing the news stories that are going on in the device reprocessing world. Hank, we're going to talk about one that has made quite a bit of headlines. You've written at least one article referring to it about Porter Adventist. They are currently being sued by, let me pull it up, 67 patients, 20 spouses, regarding infections related to what they called lapses in sterilization procedures last year, which we talked about that at that point as well. But, you know, this is one of those things that just keeps coming up. I wanted to get your initial quick read on this since you've already talked about it once. What's your initial reaction to this?
Yeah, so the Porter challenge, as we've said before, even about the issues up at Detroit Medical or really any facility that hits the news, it's not a Porter problem. It's not a Detroit problem. It's a sterile processing problem. In particular, though, for this topic, obviously the reason that we're talking about it again a number of months later is because of the lawsuits. And right. As you have mentioned before, even recently in the video that we did about the retained item, I believe it was in California, you know, there was a $34,000 fine for that item. And you expressed at that time how low that seemed to you for leaving a surgical instrument inside of someone for that long. And if you remember, I said, yeah, but wait, because we have not already – at that point, we had not seen the lawsuit, and now in Colorado, what we're starting to see is these numerous lawsuits coming down that are tying back to numerous events with dirty instrumentation, and I think this is the first of many. It's just going to become more and more as attorneys figure out how to leverage these events that should really be never events into big cases.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. And we have seen some other high dollar cases. Probably the highest dollar one that we've seen is the Olympus outbreak related to CRE with the ERCP scopes. That was a significant lawsuit in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And there was a lot that was going on with that. And like you said, you know, this is not just a Porter problem. This is not just a Detroit Medical Center problem. You know, we've seen this multiple times at multiple facilities. What we oftentimes don't see assigned to it, though, is that dollar amount. And so the reason why this is important is because we know that typically administrators for hospitals, they are assigned to watch those budgets. And one of the things that they have to watch is the number of lawsuits. And so we keep coming back to this question of what is sterile processing worth financially to a hospital? What is it worth to do it right? Or conversely, what is it worth when you're doing it incorrectly, aside from the human cost? And so oftentimes we do fixate on that number. If it's, you know, a low number like 34,000, or if it's a very high number like several hundred million, we tend to fixate on that number. But, you know, we have to remember the human cost to this. We're talking about, in this case, 67 patients, 20 spouses who are suing that hospital. You know, there were hundreds of patients who were affected at some of the previous outbreaks. And of course, the hospitals will always go to their go-to response, which is we maintain that nobody has been affected by this. Right. You know, which you actually, I learned something from you that actually comes directly from the CDC. Give me the rundown on that.
Yeah. So on the CDC website, there's a couple of different toolkits. And, you know, really they created this for marketing departments within hospitals to control the conversation, and they come out and say it. And and they outline these types of situations. If there ever is a breakdown in the sterility assurance of your instrumentation, or if there's other types of infection outbreaks, they give everyone a script. And on that script, and if you read these news articles all over the country, every hospital knows the script because they say the same thing again and again and again and again. And that same thing is, the risk is extremely low. We're doing this out of an abundance of caution.
And there you go.
There's no reason to be afraid or to be concerned. However, I love the news stories who actually talk to the patients, because when the patients get to respond, all of them say, I was mortified to get the news that I could have HIV or I could have Hep C or Hep B. I was mortified to get that call because I went in for an appendectomy. What are you saying that I could have contracted this disease? Like, I don't care what the risk is. That's not a phone call that a patient wants to get.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, to your point about the risk, you know, there's never been a number assigned to it about this is a 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, you know, but regardless of what that number is, people still play the lottery, right? They still play the lottery, and the risks there are much, much worse than whatever your risk here is. And so it's not much comfort to that patient when you say, hey, it's okay, you know, you've got a really low risk for HIV, and the patient's going to say, oh, well, okay, I feel much better now. Well, right. It's still a risk that you weren't anticipating having. But you bring up one of my kind of pet peeves is that we immediately draw all the attention to Hep B, Hep C, and HIV. Like, that's what they all focus on, because those are sort of the headline-grabbing diseases. And the reason why they're headline-grabbing, in my opinion, is because they're kind of smoking gun viruses. Mm-hmm. So there's only a very limited number of ways that you can be exposed to Hep B, Hep C, and HIV, because they're all pretty weak viruses. They have to be transmitted through bodily fluid contact, right? There's only a very limited number of ways that you can get them. The ones that we don't see talked about, I think, are actually much more risky, and that's things like MRSA, VRE. You know, those are the things that when they get into a surgical site, let's say a knee joint after a total knee procedure, those are the types of things that can end up with somebody having a non-functioning joint, end up having to have a leg amputation. You know, those don't grab the headlines quite as much, and I think the risk is far higher on something like that versus Hep B, Hep C, HIV that we normally see. So oftentimes, I mean, we see hospitals follow this script, and it's incredibly dismissive.
Right.
It's dismissive of if you've got a concern, you shouldn't. You know, you're not smart enough to understand the risk, so therefore, stop being worried about it and just leave it to the professionals. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the problem: the professionals are the reason that it happened in the first place. So your whole trust system is shot to begin with. So when they tell you just don't worry about it, do you trust them? Of course not.
Well, there's another perspective on that, right? And that's, if the risk is so low, then why do we even have to notify the patients at all?
Right. Right?
Like, if it's so safe, like, number one, why do we have to notify? So evidently there's a higher risk and is it acceptable, or we just wouldn't say anything at all. That's number one. But two, if it's such a low risk, then why don't we allow those low risk types of behaviors all the time, right? Like, if it's not going to happen, very, very low, like, let's just skip steps in the cleaning process.
Sure.
Let's not disinfect to the level that we should.
Autoclave kills everything anyway.
Right. Yeah, the magic box will take care of it. Trying to have your cake and eat it too, right? Like, try to keep your patients happy, and yet also admit, we kind of screwed up, guys, and there it could be a bigger deal than it has been. And in the case of Porter, you know, it's not, it wasn't just those dirty instruments. They are claiming, all these patients, that they can prove that their infections were caused by these dirty instruments. And in fact, even a patient has died and they're attempting to prove that death was linked to dirty instruments. So this is not a maybe it could have happened kind of thing. These folks are claiming that it did. Now these attorneys are really coming at the facility to say, we're going to show that you were negligent in all these ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that probably is one of the more significant pieces of this lawsuit, is that this is something that could be repeated throughout the country. And as you said in your article, probably will be repeated throughout the country, because we know the failures are out there. We've been in enough facilities throughout our careers that we know that they are out there. In fact, we're going to talk about here in a little bit about some testimonials from people who have also been there and have seen things. And so, and by the way, a lot of this stuff is public information. You know, if a hospital has ever been cited by a state health institution, that those documents are public records. So how long is it going to take for a patient to connect with a lawyer, to connect with one of these records where a infraction has occurred during a certain time period, and connect all those dots into a lawsuit?
Yeah.
And so, you know, the advice to administrators is you better pay attention now, because if you don't pay attention now, if you don't start giving people the tools that they need to be successful, you know, this could happen to you very, very easily.
Yeah.
And one thing I do want to really address is, I think that one thing we have to talk about is our definition of patient harm, right? So even then, even when we're discussing this, we've talked about, you know, these really severe life-altering, in some cases life-ending conditions for patient harm. But patient harm can be much more wide of a definition than something like that, right? So, for example, anesthesia is incredibly powerful. You know, we're very thankful for it. It's what enables us to do surgery in the first place. But every minute under anesthesia that you didn't have to be under anesthesia affects potentially your outcome. So if you have a patient who is under for 15 minutes extra because the back table got contaminated,
right,
and you had to switch out instrument sets, that's 15 minutes that that patient didn't have to be under anesthesia that they're going to get billed for, by the way.
Right.
And that, who knows what kind of effect that that might have on their recovery rate. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about all of these things inclusively, you know, when you say that a patient has not been harmed, did they have to wait when they didn't have to, when it wasn't absolutely necessary? That's patient harm. It's not just killing people.
Right. Well, I'm going to pull out some of my law school training here, Mike. And for those of y'all who don't know, I did a short stint in law school, you know, a year and a couple of months, right? But I learned an important lesson in my criminal law class, and that was on the topic of assault. And of course, you know, depending on the state, there can be different laws. But in cases of assault, you can actually be charged and convicted of assault without ever touching someone. And the example of that would be if I threw a golf club at you, and in anticipation of that golf club hitting you, Mike, you became afraid or concerned for your own well-being, that is assault under the law.
Yep.
In the case of all these patients, again, you know, they're under anesthesia, as you said, so they may not be aware of how close they came to being harmed if it was a dirty instrument found on the back table, or if the tray wasn't sterile, or even at the hospital, you know, they put someone under, and it's not the topic for Porter, you know, but you've been on some soapboxes, so I'm going to get on one too.
Yep, let's do it. Let's go.
We should not be putting patients asleep without all of the trays present and accounted for sterile in that room. I am so sick and tired. We're trying to play the time game. They're calling down the sterile process and say how many minutes are left on the sterilizer because the patient's on the table. And our question is, how did the patient get on the table if you knew if this tray's not ready? Like, what happens if the cycle aborts, guys? What
happens
if the PI fails? Exactly. So I have no patience for that kind of pressure from the operating room. And it's not always the operating room. Sometimes it's a surgeon. Sometimes it's scheduling. Like, all kinds of things can lead into that, you know. But we're putting sterile processing into the position to fail. And then, of course, it's sterile processing who gets the blame when something like this big happens at Porter. But it's not fair because all these different things are working together against us, right? And we don't get to decide the surgery schedule, even though we should be informing the surgery schedule. And we say, we've only got three trays, and I'm looking at this schedule, and y'all have got six cases on the board. How does this math add up?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like you said, we've spent a lot of time talking on soapboxes here, so we need to move on. We're going to do a couple of stories this time since we're live. This story comes out of Minnesota. This is an instance, another lawsuit, where a patient has successfully sued a physician for $3 million because the patient lost an eye due to an infection after surgery in 2011. I'm just going to read a little bit here, but it says, what should have been a routine procedure resulted in an infection and the loss of her eye. An expert testified the infection likely came from surgical equipment that had not been properly sterilized. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one of my many, many lawsuits, or let's read the word lawsuit, said it. One of my many, many pet peeves is trying to sort through information that's coming through news agencies, because they clearly, I don't know who they're talking to, but they obviously don't necessarily know what they're talking about. Yeah. So it's sometimes it's really difficult to sort through. So I just say, listen, if you're from a news agency, please reach out to one of us if you have one of these stories and let us explain all the nuances of what's going on. But
yeah, it's not a dishwasher.
Case, this expert claimed in court that the instrument instruments were not properly sterilized, and they sued the physician directly. Yeah. So I gather from that this is probably an ambulatory surgery center that was physician owned. That's most likely the case where you can sue a physician directly. And sure enough, they got an infection that resulted in a loss of an eye, and it cost $3 million. So again, you know, this is one of those ones where they're actually able to put a number on what is that worth, not paying attention to, you know, your processes and sterile processing.
Right. Well, I want to focus on eye instrumentation, right? Because that's the topic of this. And I have been in far too many facilities, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, in the lack of inventory to support the volume. So I understand these eye cases go quickly, guys, but just because the case goes quick does not mean that the reprocessing of those instruments can go quick. And I like to kind of give some context for folks when we're talking about cleaning and inspecting these devices. If they're being used under magnification in the OR, which these eye instruments are, then they should be assembled and inspected under magnification in sterile processing, which means you got to look at them. You have to look at every single one of those devices, even if it was not used. I know there's some places that separate the used and unused, so maybe they just used four of the 32 instruments in that eye tray, but transportation, all the handling through the decontamination phase onto the assembly side, anything can happen to these delicate eye instruments. And if you're only looking with unaided eyes at these trays to make sure that there's no visible bile burden, but you're not examining for any damage to the tips or any other lint or debris that could be on those trays, you're really doing a disservice, again, to patients like this who could lose an eye. your entire site, right? Like, we're not, it's not about the infection at this point. Like, they can't see anymore. Like, that's the level of potential risk and danger for these trays. So it's not okay for you to feel pressure from an eye surgeon who wants to do 20 procedures, but you've only got two technicians in this eye center, and you've only got 10 trays, and you can't keep up with the volume because you got a 20-year-old ultrasonic in the corner that takes, you know, 20, 30-minute cycle to get it done. Draw the line. I will be with you, and I've said this before, I'll chain myself to your department door if it means that we are keeping patients safe together. I'm willing to do that. Call me, and I'll be on the next plane out, you know, tomorrow morning, because I care about this, and I know you care about this, but I think many of y'all feel pressured to do the wrong thing because no one in your facility is giving you that support, even showing that they care about it. But I promise you, you're not alone. If you stand up and do the right thing, people will support you. And if they're not supporting you locally, I will help you find all the support that you need at the state level and definitely at the national level.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be amazed at how many times I've gone into departments to do something like deliver an in-service or, you know, talk to people. And one of the questions that inevitably comes up is, you know, do you know who your infection preventionist is? Are you working with that person? And the number of times they'll just have a blank look on their face like, no, I have no idea who that is. What's their name? You know, even if your things in your department are going great, you need to know who that person is. You need to be partnering with them. You need to be looking at your processes. But it's also really important to know that if you get in one of these situations where you need to delay processing in order to process it correctly, you need to know that you've got backup when Dr. So-and-so is yelling at you to hurry up, just throw it in the autoclave and let's move on. I've got 10 more cases to go. You need to know that you've got backup. So, you know, those are the people that you need to be talking to. You need to be talking to your infection preventionist. Most hospitals have a compliance officer. You need to know who that person is. You need to know who your risk manager is. They're the ones who deal with these types of lawsuits.
Yeah.
And honestly, I don't really feel like I'm going out on a ledge here when I tell people that, you know, if you've tried to reach out and get that support structure and it has been disregarded, you can't find any support at all, you probably need to move on to a different facility. And I know that that's not advice that comes lightly. That's not an easy thing to do. But you have to understand that if you don't have that support, you're probably not going to be able to stand up to the pressure that comes from the OR who wants to stay on schedule or the physician that wants to keep going. I want to read one particular line just because it kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the previous news story. This is a quote from the hospital, and it says, "We are sorry for the complication this patient and her family experienced. While we disagree with the allegations that the equipment was not properly sterilized, process standards have evolved." Now, when I read something like that, it always just makes me laugh, you know, because it's basically saying if the standards had to evolve, they weren't right in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Like, if they were being done correctly, what are they going to evolve to?
Well,
you know?
Yeah, so I want to jump in there then. And, you know, you're talking about standards, and this is an important piece of that ability to draw the line, to say that I'm not going to do something that is unsafe or incorrect. And in order for you to really to gain confidence, number one, but also to communicate why you're drawing the line, you've got to know the standards yourself.
Yes.
So that means get your hands on the AIME ST79 document, on the AIME ST91 document, understand the ARN guidelines or the SGNA guidelines enough so that when you draw the line and when you say no, I'm not going to do that, Dr. So-and-so, and this is why. It's not just your opinion. And, you know, one of the challenging things with this is, you know, sometimes you may feel like it's not the right thing to do, but the standards say that it is. And maybe you just misinterpreted the guidelines or don't understand the process. And so it's important before you just say no and you lose credibility that you do your homework, ask questions, email us. You know, we're more than we're more than happy to answer questions to give you those tools to be safe. But it will take some homework on the front end to educate yourself so that you can protect the patient better, but also to have those convincing dialogues, like you said, Mike, that it's not just you against the world, it's you and the infection control nurse, because you had a conversation about the standards together, and now everyone agrees that we can't just skip the ultrasonic and go directly onto the clean side through the pass-through window. That's not okay.
Yeah. So if you're going to war, make sure you have your gun loaded. That's kind of the simple way of thinking about it, right?
Yeah, we are. So, yeah. Yeah, every day it's a war on harm and risk.
Yep.
And if you're coming to that war with, I don't know, like a feather in your pocket, right? Like that's not gonna do a lot of damage. So you need to have the right tools to stand up and do the right thing for sure.
Yeah, and I know there's probably some people out there who might hear this and they say, well, you know, it's not really an even playing field. You know, there's not really a school for sterile processing. There's some training, some technical schools, but it's not like the same degree that you would get from, you know, a BSN from a state institution or a medical license. Or, you know, I understand that you don't have that sort of institutionalized training available to you yet. But what it does mean is that it puts the burden on you to do the research yourself. Understand that, you know, there are things in life that may not be fair, but it is what it is. And that's what it is in our industry. You know, we don't have the upper level education that will teach us the standards or anything like that, you know, but those resources do exist. It's just up to you to go get them. You have to go get ST7991, like you said. You have to sit down and read the manufacturer's IFUs. I mean, have you ever sat down and read through those IFUs for those eye instruments? Do you know what they say? Are you following things like Beyond the Headlines, where we talk about the results of not doing it correctly and what that financial cost is or what that patient cost is?
Yeah.
You know, that's up to you personally to do those things. Those resources are out there, but you have to go get them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, I totally agree with you, Mike. And I just want to add, though, as much as it is incumbent upon the individual to go find the resources, there's also a burden on these manufacturers to make those resources more easily available. Standardized. And, you know, the whole reason that Beyond Clean came into existence is because we saw this huge gap between all this technical knowledge over here and real life and who's communicating in between them, right? And so, like, here we are doing YouTube videos and doing podcasts and doing social media articles to try to bridge that gap so that everybody can have the same access to the same tools to provide the same level of safety to these patients. And it's a lot of work, though. Like you said, you know, I don't think folks give themselves enough credit in sterile processing for as complex of a job, as often as your hands are tied in terms of capital equipment, staffing levels, and complexity. The fact that there is not more infection and more harm than we already see, I mean, that's a testament to a lot of hard work. However, as you mentioned earlier, just because we have won the lottery in terms of not harming more patients does not mean that it's a smart decision to continue in that risky situation. So the best case scenario is to get access to those standards, learn the standards, use those to get support at your facility level, to get staffing, to get equipment, and really get understanding across the perioperative continuum so that Dr. Johnson doesn't pressure you to take shortcuts because Dr. Johnson knows that you're a subject matter expert. So he says, hey, if you're saying that it can't be done safely, I trust you because you know what you're talking about. And that's really the spot that we want to get all of our professionals in every hospital.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to tell, you know, everybody out there that just because you aren't the highest paid person in the room does not mean that you don't matter and does not mean that you aren't intelligent. You are not dumb because you don't make more money. You have an opinion. You have an incredibly important job. You can go educate yourself and become that subject matter expert. You can have those conversations, and they'll be terrifying, but you can be successful, and you can protect patients during that. Don't ever look down on yourself or your responsibilities because you don't get paid a lot. You know, that's a real problem for our area is there's this perception that because I'm the lowest guy on the totem pole, my opinion doesn't matter. There's no risk involved with me, and I must not – I can't compete with those other people. That's not true. You have those resources available. And, I mean, that really leads into the next section of topics that we wanted to talk about, which we at Beyond Clean have received a couple now of anonymous letters from frontline technicians sort of having, you know, just a confession – of desperation, considering where they are and where their departments are. Now, I'll just be completely transparent with you and everybody. Hank, you know that, you know, we have on more than one occasion been accused of being alarmists on this subject, that we are blowing something out of proportion, that there are not great risks to what's going on, that we are somehow exploiting the risks or I would say the degree of problems for whatever personal gain that we're getting out of this. I can tell you that that is absolutely categorically not true. And when we get letters like this, it further emphasizes the fact that we have a long way to go. We have a long way to go. We've made some incredible strides, but surgery is advancing very quickly, and in many cases, we're not doing a good job keeping up, and we're starting out behind to begin with. So we can talk briefly about some of the things that were brought up in this, but I'm pretty sure that as I read a couple of these, it's going to be – a lot of this is going to sound familiar, because it's stuff that has gone on in a lot of departments, including even some of my own. I will confess that there are some practices that have been brought up that I personally, early in my career, have been guilty of. You know, for example, this particular one says, you know, they're talking about dirty floors, contaminated clean floors, mishandling, cutting corners, bioburden found in the OR. And personally witnessed robot arms going straight into the washer, skipping the pre-soak, skipping the ultrasonic, hand-washing ortho instruments that were then put through the window for the purpose of flashing for the next case. And so when we talk about those things, it's impossible for me to point at something like that and be like, oh, well, that's just a cruddy department. It's widespread, and this just kind of helps illustrate that.
Yeah, well, and you know, to give a little more context, as you said, we received these anonymous letters through the info@beyondclean.net email address, and they both, you know, came within about a week of each other, but, you know, the second one came and said, hey, I saw that first letter, and it was – encouraging to me because I realized that our department is not the only one with these tremendous challenges. And to your intro, you know, we get flack because we focus on a lot of the real risks and dangers in sterile processing. But anyone who listens to us, if you listen to the podcast, if you read the articles, you hear us say time and time again, this industry is full of heroes, right? So we're not saying that all of our teams, like, we're just totally dropping the ball and we're doing a horrible job. What we're saying is, even with all of those heroes, the complexity, the challenge, the lack of support, the lack of training and education, and yes, at times, the folks in the industry that maybe shouldn't be here, this is not their calling. They don't have attention to detail. They don't value the patient above everything. There are folks like that in sterile processing. And sometimes you will end up with a department almost full of those types of folks. And that's where you really get into the danger zone, because there's no one there to stop the line. And to that first letter, you know, I mailed a response because the person was asking, you know, what do I do? Is this the reality for sterile processing? They were newer to the industry. I think this was their first department. And they just said, I got into this job because my mother died of infection in surgery, and I want to help every other family not have to go through that. And the person was like, is this the reality? Is everybody cutting corners and doing these kinds of things? And, you know, truth be told, no. Like, not everybody is in a tremendously challenged department. That being said, as you mentioned, many folks have some type of challenge there. So it might be certain people, it may be certain shifts, it may be certain types of instrumentation that there's more pressure to turn around than others, or less training on the equipment. There's all level of complexity that plays into the risk and danger inherent in this. But I told her, and this is going back to something that you said, I think maybe in the first segment, but you have two options, right? You can stay and you can try to be the guiding light in the department that kind of raises the flag and says, guys, this is not okay. We can't cut corners. We can't take shortcuts, and help be a conduit for education and encouragement, because we want to assume the best, right? So maybe these folks just don't know. Maybe they've never been told. Maybe they are certified, but they're not applying that knowledge to their everyday work life. Like, there's a lot of reasons that it could be, but that's one option, to stay and try to be the person that turns it around. But you and I both know, and many folks watching this, that it's hard if you're the only
person. It's a long and lonely road, so you better buckle up.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. And as a quote that I'm going to totally butcher here to paraphrase, but that there's an infinite difference between 1 and 0 and 1 and 1. If you have just one other person there with you, that makes all the difference. Two people can drive tremendous amounts of change, but if you're there by yourself and you're really the only person trying to turn the ship, yes, it can be very, very difficult. So to your second point, at a time, you may just have to pull the plug and say, guys, I can't in good conscience continue to put my name on these trays, that this whole process is so broken that I'm not comfortable caring for patients under my own conscience, right? And as we said, there's departments out there who are doing it right, who are trying very, very hard to follow the standards, to pay their folks well, to raise the entire tenor of professionalism in sterile processing. There's a lot of departments out there, and there's more and more coming up. However, there's a lot of other ones that still have tremendous challenges.
Yeah, and actually I was in a department not terribly long ago that was at one time probably one of the most backward and just bad departments I've ever seen. But through the efforts of a few key leaders in the past, it took a good several years, and almost a complete turnover in staffing. That wasn't intentional. That was just the way it played out. But that department has been rehabbed and is now an excellent, excellent department. You know, to your point, change is possible. The ship can be righted. The information is out there. It's just a matter of utilizing the tools and deciding to set your face towards doing that, determining to do it, and do it. If you can find the support. And like I said, I mean, I feel like a broken record on the IP thing, but I mean, it's for a really good reason that if you are able to give that information to an IP, you can win over support very quickly. Like you can get an ally in a hurry, just by providing the proper information, to the proper people. And so, you know, it is possible to turn it over. It is possible to right the ship, but I also want to be very clear that just because you improve it up to a point where it went from being bad to good, you're not done. This is a ever-changing, ever-evolving process, and every time a new surgical instrument comes out, a new procedure is created, you know, there is that is time that we have to spend learning and growing and changing what our best practices are specific to any of those things. So it's always moving forward. And that's why we've said multiple times on the show that, you know, that process improvement, that quality, it's not like a one-time program where it's like, okay, well, we know that we're not in great shape. So we got to do this, this, and this. And so then we're fixed and then we're good. Right. Like that's not the way it works. It has to be a culture of constantly pursuing the best. And, you know, it's possible to get there. Like you said, there are departments who are doing that. There are departments who welcome the idea of a compliance survey, not because they're doing things badly, but because they want an extra pair of eyes to come in there and say, what are we missing? Show us so that we can fix it. Those departments exist. And when they're going, man, those are wonderful places to be.
Yeah. And I mean, I want to touch on one of those things and then go on to another topic is, I've talked about a lot and I've written about it more, but humility.
Yeah.
Guys, what is killing us, culturally speaking, as departments, and who knows, potentially killing patients, is our pride. If you think that you know everything, if you think you have arrived, and I'm not just talking about leadership, I'm talking about technicians. If you think just because you have a couple of letters behind your name that now you know everything there is to know and anything that you do is right and safe and good, there is tremendous risk there. I urge you to keep that professional humility, to never think that you have arrived, and to treat every day as an opportunity to learn something that you did not know the previous day in order to keep patients safe. It's not about acting like, and I know the pressure, guys, especially for managers and directors, because I have been through it, especially if you have been promoted inside of a hospital from a technician up to the manager role. Everybody knows you. They know what you used to do. They know the corners that you used to cut. It can be difficult to make that transition internally. So sometimes these managers try to take on this air of, all right, now I'm a manager, so now anything that I say is correct and anything that I do it is compliant, and that is just not the case. So we've got a lot of leaders out there that are leading in the wrong direction because they feel like they can't show any weakness, or it says that they were the wrong choice, so that they're not a good leader. No, no, no. Mm-hmm. A good leader understands the risk here and that it's not worth pride to make an incorrect decision. So as you said, Mike, if it's getting another set of eyes in there, if it's having to make a phone call because you're not exactly sure the best decision in this situation, y'all, swallow the pride, have some humility, and keep some patients safe. It is not worth it. So so that's number one. Number two, in the second anonymous letter, one of the things that jumped out to me in that I don't know, Mike, if you have talked about it here recently or if it's because we have a podcast that's coming out soon about it, but it was about the lack of laparoscopic testing.
Yeah.
And in the letter, this person said, I don't even know what that equipment is called that we use to test laparoscopic instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that honesty. Like, you know, that's humility there. I don't even know what that thing is called because we never use it and it doesn't work and it just sits in the corner. Now,
yep.
You can start there. Like, that's the place to start, guys. I don't know what it is. We're not using it. I know that's wrong. Now, what do I do? I can start with you at that point. But if you're acting like you're doing it, if you're telling everyone you're doing it, if you're telling the manager that you're doing it, but when the manager clocks out and goes home, then everyone stops laparoscopic testing, who are you hurting? Or, you know, who are you serving? And you're serving yourself, but you're hurting the patient. What are you doing, guys? So that's a small part of this whole quality program, but it's such a critical part, and it hits home for me because about a year ago I had an appendectomy, and I remember before the procedure the nurse came in, it was like, it's going to be fine because we do this new thing called minimally invasive, and so we're just going to cut little holes. And I'm thinking to myself, no, I know what happens here, and it, I don't feel comfortable with this.
Yeah, and I mean, you're absolutely right on the humility thing, and I think it is because we do have an episode coming out. I think it may actually be Monday, where we discuss the importance of that laparoscopic insulation tester. And that is a particular hobby horse of mine because I think that in all the sterile processing experience and all the sterile processing technicians that I've discussed, one of the most common threads that you will find is we want to know what we do matters, right? We want to know that we make a difference to the patient. And this is one subject where we have multiple peer-reviewed journals, we have multiple news reports that demonstrate that a failure to test insulation on laparoscopic instruments can and has resulted in significant patient harm and deaths.
Right.
So there is zero reason that we should not be doing this. I understand that. I mean, I get it that sometimes you've got a problem if you think, well, you know, do I have to ultrasonic that for 15 minutes when you know, the IFU says 20, like, is 5 minutes really going to make that big of a difference? Like, I understand that there's questions there. There is no question on this one, none. And so if you aren't doing this, if you don't know how to do this, this has to be fixed. It has to be fixed in your department. If your insulation tester doesn't work, as in the case here, this is something that has to be taken care of immediately. There are multiple places you can get one of these things from, and all of them are willing to train you on it. And even then, if you still don't know, you can reach out to us and we'll talk you through it. There's just no reason not to be doing this because this really is something that we do, or in many cases choose not to do, that will result in patient harm.
Yeah, Mike, you've given me an idea. I think we need to reach out to one of these manufacturers of the testing devices and do a giveaway through the Facebook group, you know, hopefully we're giving it away to a department that already has one of those testers at least, you know, but I've been to some large departments that have one tester. And question again is, if you're processing multiple laparoscopic trays at the same time, are you telling me that you're waiting around for that one tester? This is not like the whole, every three times we test the scissor sharpness, right? Like every Wednesday we test scissors. That's not what we're talking about. It only takes one nick, and now you have a compromise in a laparoscopic instrument that can cause serious infection and death, and not can cause, has caused and is documented in all those reports that you mentioned, this is not a game to play. And it's not one of those situations where we're talking about a $250,000 cart washer or autoclave. Like, these things are affordable. They're small. They're compact. They're not too complex.
You can oftentimes get them for free.
Yeah. There's no excuse. And, you know, I don't want anyone in an apartment who doesn't have one, you know, to feel attacked here. Like, we're not attacking you. We're attacking the fact that our industry has been okay ignoring the glaring danger in something so simple with a simple solution in the fact that we can test. So I can hear now, because I hear it every time that I have one of these compliance conversations, but you're thinking, I've got 12 major lap trays and we're using them very often. You're telling me that now I have to test every one of those devices? We're not going to have time. We're not going to get done. We're already not getting the laparoscopic trays done, and they're sitting there at 7 a.m. in the morning. So what Mike and I are telling you is, first thing, walk down to your infection control department and then swing by and talk to your risk department and say, hey, guys, let me give you these articles on all of the implications for laparoscopic burns. Mm-hmm. Now let me tell you that we don't have enough time to do this in the current workflow. Please help me figure it out. If it's more people, if it's we schedule these procedures on different days, that's where the decision has to be made, not do I test and do I not? Okay, I'm not, because that's the only way that we can keep up with the volume. That's not the right decision.
Yeah, and you bring up we've already mentioned this several times about the need for collaboration. I can promise you that if you get really fired up listening to, you know, our podcast or, you know, listening to whatever, and you decide that you're just going to walk in the OR and go Rambo, and it's going to be you versus them, and you're like, that is a recipe for failure right there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to work. Collaborate. Build those relationships. Use the resources. That is how change is implemented. And so, it's very important to build those relationships for the purpose of effecting change. Because at the end of the day, it's not about having sort of a self-righteous hill to die on. Mm-hmm. Even if you're right in the process, mm-hmm. it's about doing what is most effective in order to cause change.
Right.
And in order to cause the change, you have to collaborate. Hospitals are complex organisms. And so the only way that anything gets done is when you have multiple people all pulling in the same direction. And so that, again, we've said this, I think, 5 times in this episode already. If you don't have a friend in infection prevention, stop what you're doing and make that your priority. Find that person, befriend them, and start working together to effect that change.
Yeah. And if you need some insight, I know the first episode ever of the Beyond Clean podcast, we actually talked to Mike Matthews.
And never heard of him.
This was before Mike was a co-host with us, or as we say today, a co-troublemaker. And the whole episode was about collaboration with infection control. So obviously that's something that Mike's been passionate about for a long time and for good reason. But that's a whole almost 45 minutes to an hour episode about how to make that happen and why it's important. So if you're interested in that, go check it out. It's episode number one. And I just want to close on my side to say how you have an opportunity still today. If you need more advice or if you need a little more courage to do some of the things that we're talking about today, to raise your hand and say, I'm not comfortable, or to make a request to say, we need a laparoscopic testing device, or we need to slow down the volume on Tuesday for eye procedures because we just can't keep up safely, or I need a magnification device or a microscope to look at these all these delicate instruments and I need time to do so. If you need encouragement, you can email us. You can contact us at any time. Mike is mike@beyondclean.net. I'm Hank at beyondclean.net, or you can email info@beyondclean.net, and all of that's going to come to us. We check that email every single day, and any questions or anything that we can help you do the right thing, guys, that's why we're here. That's why we're doing this. So please take advantage of that. It's a tremendous asset. And if we don't know the answer to the question, which there's many questions that we don't, we can find the answer for you, because we've got a tremendous network of true subject matter experts in the industry all around the world who can help to find those answers for you.
Yeah, I mean, as we've talked about many times, sometimes it's not about knowing the answer, it's about knowing where to find the answer. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to pretend like we know all of it, but we know where to find most of them. And I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't mention, particularly for leaders who are growing in this field, maybe you're new in the management position, you're just learning about some of this stuff, maybe you're trying to figure out how to right the ship, Beyond Clean has a very special program where you can get partnered up for mentorship with one of the great leaders in our industry, Bob Mars. He's one of our vice presidents. He has a mentorship program that you can get into, and you will learn how to do these things. It's a very, very important tool that I just feel like if you're new in leadership and you aren't taking advantage of this, you're really missing out, because it is a tremendous opportunity to learn from one of the greats. That's all I've got. Hank, have you got anything else?
Good.
I think I'm ready to sign off on our first ever live event. That was a lot of fun.
We made it.
Yeah, we made it. Yeah, cool. So, if there's anything else, I got to fly in here. If there's anything else that, you guys want to talk about, please feel free to send us an email to info@beyondclean.net. We'll be happy to talk about it. Until then, keep fighting dirty.